So, last time I started talking about a toy example of a quantum mechanical system that starts in its ground state and ends in an excited state. The time-dependent simple harmonic oscillator. Where I assume that the frequency omega is equal to omega naught at early times. It can change, but for t goes to t0, the frequency approaches some constant. And as initial conditions, I'm assuming that the system is in its ground state at early times. And we solved this problem in the Heisenberg picture. We found these found exact solutions for the Heisenberg picture, momentum and position operators, where just as notation, when I write a ladder operator A, I mean the operator at the initial time, which is not the same thing as either the Schrodinger picture operator at time t. That would be something like this. And it's not the Heisenberg picture ladder operator at time t would be this. So just as last time I was writing the A of t naught set explicitly, but today, just for notational compactness, when I write a ladder operator A, I mean this operator, which is time independent and not either of these two. Okay. And the function u of t here was the mode function, which solves the Heisenberg picture equation of motion. That's the same thing as the equation of motion for a classical trajectory, but now it's a coefficient in the Heisenberg picture operator. With the initial conditions that the mode function looks like this at early times. This came out, these initial conditions. Came out of writing down the Heisenberg picture operators at early times when the system is a time-independent simple harmonic oscillator, and we know how to solve it. So if you just integrate this one, given a specific form of omega of t, you integrate this one differential equation with these initial conditions, and you solve the quantum theory in that you know what coefficients to put here in the Heisenberg picture operators. The reason that counts as solving the theory is that if I want to calculate an expectation value, like the expectation value of x squared at time t, that could be written either in the Schrodinger picture, like this, or in the Heisenberg picture, like this, you leave the system in its initial state. So if I plug in my plug in my expression for the Heisenberg picture operator. Now, this term goes away because A annihilates the vacuum ket, and this term goes away because A dagger annihilates the vacuum bra, leaving behind this, which is equal to 1. And you can compute the expectation value of any operator on the system at time t, for example, the expectation value of x to the fourth. By a similar procedure, there just may be more terms, and you might need to use the canonical commutation relation for it. So that's why we say that we solve the quantum, this is the solution of the quantum theory, and that we can compute any expectation value of interest. One little thing that sometimes comes up in calculations is that last time we observed that this Heisenberg picture commutator is always equal to I. Because that's true for the corresponding Schrodinger. That's always true for the corresponding Schrodinger picture operators, and the Heisenbergization commutes with the commutator. If you write that out for what it says about the mode functions, if I plug in these expressions for the Heisenberg picture operators and use this commutation relation, then I get the following identity involving the mode function. It's not obvious that this is equal to I, given our definition of the mode function here as being the solution of this differential equation with these initial conditions. And so that's a non-obvious and useful identity when doing calculations. If you want to prove this, it should be possible to prove this from our definition of the mode function so that everything is consistent. And one way to prove it is to first show that it's true at early times by plugging in those initial conditions. Then you can check that the derivative of the right-hand side is equal to 0. If I take the derivative, I'll get two terms that cancel, and then two terms with u double dot, and the u double dot here and the u double dot here. And those will cancel each other by the using the classical equation of motion. So either because we know that this canonical commutation relation has to hold, or by giving a direct proof using the differential equation for u, this is equal to I, and it's useful. Now, one more comment on this problem that I think is kind of interesting and worth doing is that if we say that we've solved the theory, but we never computed the wave function, like the Schrodinger picture wave function, it ought to be the case that we can infer or reverse engineer the wave function from our Heisenberg picture equation of motion. After all, these equations should completely characterize the state at time t. So I just want to sketch that because I think there's one thing about it that we actually want to point out, one property of the wave function that I want to point out. I also think it's just fun to see how Schrodinger picture quantum mechanics and Heisenberg picture quantum mechanics interconvert. So, given this, you can pose the problem this way. Given this solution from the theory, how can we write down the Schrodinger picture wave? What we want to do is, at the initial time, the state of the system is characterized by the statement that the lowering operator annihilates it. We want to replace this equation by something where I have a Heisenberg picture operator at time t here. So if I take this system, if you get the idea to invert it, this matrix is invertible because its determinant equals so-called Wronskian determinant, equals this commutator, which we know is equal to I, not zero. So if I invert to solve for A and A dagger in terms of these Heisenberg picture operators, then I get the following answer. I'm glossing over a few details because this issue of solving for the wave function is not super important except for one little property I will. So if you invert this matrix, this is what you also get an equation for a dagger. Then I know that I should get zero if I apply A to the initial state, so then I'll plug in now I have some Heisenberg picture operators annihilating the initial state. By definition, those Heisenberg picture operators are related to the Schrodinger picture operators like this, where U is the time evolution operator. I can cancel this since evolution is invertible and I have zero on the other side. And then here I'll plug in. And then this is equal to the state of the system at time t. So now I ended up with, through this translation back and forth between the two pictures, I have some equation that describes the state of the system. If I write it out in the usual Schrodinger equation type notation, the condition is u dot star times x plus u star times minus id by dx applied to the wave function has to be zero. And now I have a differential equation that I can solve for the wave function. And a short calculation. This is a separable differential equation that is can be solved with a few lines of algebra. And you get this. This differential equation doesn't determine, because it's a differential equation that only involves x derivatives at one time at a time. It doesn't determine this time-dependent prefactor. But if you want that prefactor, you can get it by going back to the original Schrodinger equation. You plug this into the original Schrodinger equation. Good luck like this. Then you get a differential equation for A that you can solve. I just skipped over some steps here because I really just wanted to emphasize two things. One is that the Heisenberg picture and the Schrodinger picture contain equivalent information, and you can always go back and forth. It's just a lot more convenient for these linear problems to use the Heisenberg picture. Secondly, if you just take the Schrodinger equation with this time-dependent term, it's not so easy to get this solution. But in the Heisenberg picture, it emerges sort of. The other thing that I want to point out is that the wave function is Gaussian. So the wave function here. The wave function here looks like e to some complex number times x squared, where a is complex. Let's write it as a plus. If I square the wave function, because I'm interested in probability and not phase, this just looks like that. The sine of a, of course, would be negative, so that it's normalizable. So it's a theorem about our time-dependent harmonic oscillator that if it starts in its ground state, the same would be true if you started in any state that was annihilated by some linear combination of A and A dagger. That's called a Bogoliubov state. But the evolution always keeps the system in such a Bogoliubov state, and the wave function or the probability distribution of such a state is Gaussian. So this is the reason why the perturbations generated by inflation end up being a Gaussian field. Two things are true about inflation. One is that it produces the right power spectrum, and the other is that it produces Gaussian fluctuations, which is a stronger statement. Gaussian fluctuations mean that each Fourier mode of the field follows a Gaussian distribution with a width determined by the power spectrum. That will happen because each K mode of the field will behave like an independent harmonic oscillator with some time-dependent coefficients. And it's just always true that no matter the time dependence, you are ending up with a Gaussian wave function. This is just something that comes out of analyzing the quantum mechanics of a time-dependent harmonic oscillator. Something that I think is physically interesting is that if you didn't know any physics and you were looking at the CMB, and you notice that it looked like a Gaussian field, the hot and cold spots were Gaussian, then it would be very natural to look for an explanation of the fluctuations that involve the central limit theorems. That some sort of explanation that involves building up the fluctuations as accumulation of uncorrelated contributions. That would seem really natural. As far as I can tell, it's a coincidence that the Gaussian functional form of e to the minus x squared occurs in two contexts, both in the central limit theorem in statistics and in the wave functions of time-dependent harmonic oscillator. Those two things have nothing to do with each other, and it's for the second reason that the CMB looks like a Gaussian field. There's no accumulation of independent statistical contributions. The universe is in a pure state. It's just that the wave function is Gaussian for a quantum mechanical reason. Okay. Well, so much for the time-dependent simple harmonic oscillator. Now I want to talk about some QFT examples, starting with the example of a massive scalar field in a non-dynamical De Sitter spacetime. So I'm not putting fluctuations in the metric and worrying about gauge symmetry and all the GR issues. I'm just taking the metric to be a fixed spectrum. In De Sitter, let me remind you that the Hubble parameter is constant. The expansion looks like In proper time, it has a exponential scale effect. Time goes from minus infinity to infinity. We showed this before, that this scale factor in De Sitter is e to the ht. If you convert this to conformal time, I don't think we did this yet, but it's easy to show by a little calculation that in conformal time, the scale factor is 1 over h tau, and the conformal time goes from minus infinity to zero. De Sitter space has an infinite conformal horizon in the past, but a finite conformal horizon in the future, and it's convenient to put the future horizon at tau, define the future horizon to be tau equals zero. And we're going to use conformal time. So the action is... this in covariant form. Because the metric here is just a non-dynamical FRW metric, I don't need to use ADM variables or do anything particularly fancy. I just translate that. If I plug in this form of the metric and go to Fourier space, then I get this action. This should be fine. Okay. Each k-mode of phi is behaving as a time-dependent harmonic oscillator. But previously, we had time dependence just on the x-squared. And here we have time dependence on both the p-squared and the x-squared. So if we really wanted to make this look like, if we really wanted to make each k-mode look like a time-dependent harmonic oscillator with the type of time dependence that we studied before, what we could do is canonically normalize by defining the field psi to be phi over h tau. Canonically normalizing a field in field theory just means redefining the field so that the coefficient of the phi dot squared in the action is the usual 1/2. So if I switch variables from analyze the system in canonical normalization first, and then I'll talk about phi. So if I change variables to phi, then I get this. In this step, I'm just multiplying everything out. Okay. Now, after canonical normalization, the psi dot squared term has the usual prefactor of a half. This term looks like our time-dependent harmonic oscillator. These terms, where I have a psi dot times psi, can be treated by integration by parts. If I integrate by parts on this term, then I'll get I'll pick up a minus sign. I'll move the derivative over so that it cancels this term. And then I also get a term where with a minus sign where the derivative acts at 1 over 2 tau. So it's convenient to do that integration by parts to get rid of the mixed terms with both psi dot and psi. Write the result this way. I just get a factor of 2 in this coefficient. Now each k mode of the field looks like our time-dependent harmonic oscillator, where this is omega squared. In this example, the omega squared goes negative, which is may seem a little odd physically, but only at late times. We have a harmonic oscillator and an inverted potential. So you might think that we get runaway behavior, but because it only happens for a finite conformal time, everything will still stay. It will turn out that everything still stays finite. Okay. So now if we... Oh, notice also that at early times, when tau goes to minus infinity, omega is approaching some constant k at early time. So now in this canonical variable, it really is just an independent, decoupled, time-dependent harmonic oscillator at each k mode. And we're going to assume that the system starts in its vacuum state. So we just apply what we worked out before. So starting in the vacuum state, in the variable psi, we know that the Heisenberg picture equation of motion looks like this. Where the mode function u obeys the differential equation. Now we have something specific to put in for the omega squared in the classical equation of motion. The initial conditions is that this mode function u should go as this, as tau goes to minus infinity. Okay. Now it happens that for the de Sitter expansion, this differential equation with this initial conditions has an exact solution. The mode function looks like this. This is actually not so easy to derive, and I don't really know of a good way of just starting with this differential equation and ending up with this by some sort of like simple systematic procedure. Of course, it's easy to verify that if you plug this in, it solves the differential equation. But coming up with it is not so easy. For example, if I put in a little plus epsilon here, then the solution is really complicated. It involves a spherical Bessel function, or a non-spherical ordinary Bessel function. And then there's some Bessel function identity that for a particular value of the nu in the Bessel function, it has a simple closed form like this. I guess this differential equation is really Bessel's differential equation, these guys. I did check that if you put the differential equation into Mathematica, it just spits out the answer right away. So maybe that's the right answer in 2018 if you get a tough differential equation. So this is the solution. We've solved this QFT, this free QFT. In the original field variable, I equals h tau sub, then write the I like to go back and forth between the canonically normalized variable and the field that we started with. I'll use the subscript on the mode function to indicate which field it is. Of course, the mode function u phi is just h tau times the mode function u sub. Or h over 2k to the 3 half plus ik tau e to the minus ik. I actually pulled out an extra a factor of I here since the overall is the same. And this is what's usually called the de Sitter mode function. The mode function which solves the free theory and the original field variable phi. So now would be a good time to compute the power spectrum. The power spectrum of the theory. Observationally, we're interested in the power spectrum at the end of inflation, but we can compute it at an arbitrary time tau and then plug in tau equals zero. Let's compute this expectation value where the fields are evaluated at the same time, the equal time correlator, but at wave number k not equal to k prime. We expect to end up with a delta function k minus k prime in the final answer by translations. So this would be, this is just like the calculation for the time-dependent spherical simple harmonic oscillator of the expectation value of x squared. This is given by taking the initial vacuum state of the theory, which is annihilated by every lowering operator, ak, and evaluating applying Heisenberg picture operators to the initial state. And if I plug in those expressions, all right, this guy is u phi a tau star a dagger. Well, I should put the dagger here. This is an option. Plus u phi. Okay. Times u phi at k prime.
This should have been mine.
The lowering operator annihilates the something else. Well, this should have been a star. The lowering operator annihilates the vacuum pet, and the raising operator annihilates the vacuum broth. And the answer is and this expectation value is, let me do that on a separate line. This expectation value is 2 pi cubed times the delta function that we expected. And one way of seeing that is to recall that for ladder operators in QFT, this canonical commutator has a delta function on the right-hand side. So if I commute this guy past this guy, I pick up the delta. At time zero. Oh, now I'll plug in the mode function. Let's write this as h over 2 k cubed 1 plus k squared tau squared 2 pi cubed. So this is the power spectrum at time tau. At the end of inflation, or at in the far future at tau equals zero, the power spectrum is, sorry, this should have been h squared. The power spectrum is h squared over 2 k cubed. And this is a scale invariant power spectrum. This is related, the fact that you get a scale invariant power spectrum in the end is related to the existence of a symmetry under Sitter space, which translates in time and dilates space. Because the spatial dilation is part of that symmetry, then there's no preferred scale, there's no preferred length scale in Sitter space. And the answer is, you have to get a scale invariant power spectrum in the end. Although that's a very hand wavy proof. It could be unraveled in more detail. The power spectrum is scale invariant, and the typical size of the fluctuations, the characteristic size of a fluctuation is, remember that the dimensionless power spectrum, we were talking about power spectrum, we defined the dimensionless power spectrum to be this. There's a factor of 2 pi squared, which is so important. Was could be interpreted as the square of the size of a typical fluctuation. Here the dimensionless power spectrum is of order h squared. So the typical size of the of a fluctuation delta phi that's quantum mechanically produced is of order h. That's how I would interpret this power spectrum. So the Hubble, in the center space, the Hubble expansion rate of the space is setting the size of the fluctuations that are produced in the end. It will turn out that in inflation, for this reason, the gravity waves have a typical size of order h over m. So that measurement of gravity waves would, if you believe that single field inflation is the truth, if we and we one day observe gravity waves in the CMB, then that would be pinning down the Hubble scale or the energy scale of inflation in Planck units. I'll do that calculation. You might wonder whether in this one more comment on this example is that you might wonder whether it's really necessary to canonically normalize. We had this kind of roundabout way of doing the calculation where we started with an action, changed field variables to canonical normalization, and then put in the h taus at the end to get the mode function. One reason why the change of variable helped is that it let us. The only place where we really used it was in reading off the initial conditions. You could have just worked in the original variable and said that the in the original field variable phi, I could have just said, well, I know the solution to the theory is going to look like this, where the mode function is going to obey the classical equation of motion, which is this. The only thing that's unclear is what initial conditions take. If you, so as a shortcut, if you cheat a little bit and you remember that the initial conditions are always going to be always going to contain a phase of the form e to the minus ik tau with no e to the plus ik tau term. Then the prefactor that sits in front can be inferred from the canonical normalization condition. So in this example, as a shortcut to getting the initial conditions, it doesn't require going through canonical normalization. This is the way that it's usually done in papers, is to leave the, rather than canonically normalize, leave the problem in its original variables, and then write down the canonical commutator. The momentum, remember the momentum conjugate to a field variable phi is always defined by differentiating the action with respect to the field variable, so that here it's 1 over h tau squared times phi dot. So if you put that in, the canonical commutator is telling you that this identity has to be true. And that, if I plug in the early time behavior of the mode function, gives me this. So that's another way of thinking about the initial conditions that works in any field variable and doesn't require canonical normalization. That at early times, they just have this e to the minus ik tau form with a coefficient that you can infer from writing out the canonical This is the only part of the calculation, by the way, this initial conditions that requires input that's not in the classical equations of motion. To write down this equation, you know, I just need the classical equations of motion. And it's sort of easy when you do these calculations to forget that you're doing quantum mechanics, because the equations that you're solving are just the same equations as a classical trajectory. The only place where you need to really put quantum mechanics in is writing down this canonical commutator and working out the initial conditions. For example, if you rescale the action by a constant, then the classical equations of motion are unchanged, but the initial conditions do change. I guess the A factor here has to get divided by the square root of A, right? I used A twice. If I scale the action by some constant, then the A factor here would get divided by the square root of lambda, since I would have two lambdas in the canonical. So the absolute normalization of the action matters in quantum mechanics, but not in classical. Okay. So now I'm ready to talk about. I'm warming up to the action of single field inflation. I want to do one more toy example, which I'll do quickly since it's similar to the non-dynamical de Sitter case. So I want to talk about the massless scalar in a non-dynamical FRW space. This will be the this will generalize the preceding example where the scale factor in conformal time was 1 over h tau to an arbitrary a of tau. So here you can write the action. You can solve the problem either in the original field variable or after canonically normalizing. In the original field variable phi, this would be the action. The classical equation of motion for the mode function would look like this. I don't want to do this side by side on two blackboards. Here's the action in the phi variable. Let me just come back to the initial conditions in a minute. If I canonically normalize by defining psi equals a phi, then the action after an integration by parts, like this, The classical equation for the mode function is... Oops. So here are the in the canonical variable. The initial conditions would look like this. Given a specific form of A of tau, I could try to integrate this differential equation. The variable phi, the initial conditions, therefore, would look like this. That is A to the minus 1.
A of tau.
So this initial condition is maybe not so easy to see, even if you write out the canonical commutator. I do think the initial conditions are a lot easier to write down in canonically normalized field. Now it's easier to think about. We'll be interested in the case where the expansion is close to de Sitter, but not quite. So that this term is almost the 2 over tau squared that we had before. In particular, this term will go away at early times. So in the early time limit, it's easier to use the canonically normalized variable, where the equation of motion is just an ordinary harmonic oscillator. And one way to interpret that is that in a de Sitter spacetime, or a spacetime that's close to de Sitter, there's a natural horizon size, which is 1 over ah. This is a co-moving distance. And so it's rapidly decreasing. At some point it crosses the co-moving wavelength of the mode. At early times, the causal horizon, or the length scale of the de Sitter space, is large compared to the wavelength of the mode, and the mode doesn't feel the expansion of the universe, so to speak. The mode just thinks that it's a free field in Minkowski that's oscillating harmonically. At late times, the horizon is much smaller than the wavelength of the mode, and different pieces of the mode are causally disconnected from each other. So there's no way for the mode to know that it has a gradient, and it's just frozen at late times. So at late times, it's simpler to think about the variable phi. And what will happen is that the mode function will just freeze to a constant value. That can be seen from the differential equation. For example, in the de Sitter case, the mode function for phi looks like 1 plus ik tau e to the minus ik tau, and it was just freezing to a constant as tau went to 0. A very useful formula that I can be derived by matching the solution in these two regimes is that the square of the mode function looks like h squared over 2k cubed plus plus terms that are suppressed by one or more powers of the Slowell parameters epsilon and eta, where h star is the Hubble parameter evaluated at the time of horizon crossing when k is equal to ah. That is the time when the co-moving causal horizon is equal to the wavelength of the mode. I don't think I'm going to prove this just because there's only one lecture remaining and I want to finish a little more material. It's definitely not easy to prove, but it can be proved by carefully matching solutions in the early time and late time regimes. I'll try to put a proof of this in the notes. In the de Sitter case, the h here is constant, it didn't matter what value of the time we evaluated it at. But in the near de Sitter case, where h is slowly varying, then it turns out that you get the same answer up to slow roll corrections if you evaluate h at the time of horizon crossing. So this is a good time to stop. I did non-dynamical examples of QFTs, time-dependent QFTs with non-dynamical metrics. Next time we'll do the single field inflation case where we worked out the action and the metric can have fluctuations too.